Last year, 54 journalists were killed while doing their jobs. Hundreds more are in jail, and press freedom is being threatened even in democracies. Today on the 21st, we're joined by the director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Joel Simon. Plus, Democrats have been busy passing bills in the State House and Senate, and many of those have one thing in common. Those bills were either voted down last year or vetoed by our last governor, Bruce Rauner.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekend. And congratulations to Bradley University for qualifying for March Madness. If you have not filled out your bracket, I hope everybody picks Bradley and is cheering for them. Coming up this hour, I will be speaking with Joel Simon, the director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He leads a nonprofit that defends not just press freedom, but the hundreds of journalists who are attacked, imprisoned, or killed every year across the world. First, it's been about 2 months since the Democrats took control of every statewide office here in Illinois. Enough seats in the legislature to have a supermajority. In practice, that's meant a lot of progressive bills have been signed into law pretty quickly. For example, a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour over the next 6 years passed both houses and was signed by the governor all before his first budget address. There were a few more bills that hit the governor's desk last week, possibly more on the way. And for more on that, I'm joined by Mark Maxwell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA3. Doug Finke is also with us. He's a State House reporter for the State Journal Register. Good morning, guys. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Good morning.
Glad to be here.
I'm not going to ask you about your brackets yet. If you have them filled out, we will talk politics instead.
Mark, in a split screen.
Okay, there you go. Mark, you know, we often talk about the first 100 days in a presidency that are the most important. And when you're talking about state government, I wonder if there's how important it is to have things achieved sort of right out of the gate for, in this case, Governor Pritzker as he's taking office.
Well, we've certainly learned that this governor does or has demonstrated that he wants to make a bold first impression. If anybody thought he might sort of tiptoe and test the waters first, he's coming in with quite a splash, passing a $15 minimum wage and really muscling that through the House and the Senate early on showed that he really wants to not tinker around the margins but drive at the heart of what he sees are some economic issues in the state. That didn't come without some loud objections from the business community, but we're certainly seeing a new day in Springfield, as many of the Democrats lauded that when Governor Pritzker was inaugurated, and now he does have some legislative successes to show for it.
I thought I would play for you guys a clip from a conversation we had last week with Democratic State Representative Kelly Cassidy. She's been working on a bill called the Reproductive Health Act. And I asked her whether she was worried about getting support for her bill from Republicans or downstate Democrats. Here's what she told us.
Just as with every bill, you know, there are 118 of us and we come into the room with 118 opinions. I only need 60 of them.
Doug, what do you make of that? I wonder if some ways that her comment might apply to the entire session.
Well, it probably does, although abortion certainly is a different kind of topic because it doesn't break along party lines as much as some other issues do. That is the calculus basically of the entire session is you need 60 votes in the House to pass a bill and 30 in the Senate. You know, as long as you can get those by any means possible, that is your key to success.
And so when we think about, Mark, this whole idea of everyone likes to talk about bipartisanship, is the reality of this really you just need that calculus of these votes and that's really what is happening now as we're getting into bills being passed and sort of the nitty-gritty of all of that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose a lot of that, we will find out just how true the nod or the lip service of bipartisanship has been when we get to the deadline. That's where the deal making really starts to happen, in the 11th hour, when the budget deadline is here at the end of May. So check back in a couple months, right? And we'll find out just how committed this Democratic governor is to true bipartisanship when he actually needs to reach across the aisle and procure some of those tougher to get votes on some bigger projects. So we'll see if that happens. So far, this has been a very Democratic agenda with very little Republican support.
And so go ahead, Doug.
I'm sorry. That's a very good point, because as you pointed out, the first bill right out of the box that the governor pushed for was a minimum wage. That was basically a Democratic initiative. The Republicans complained that he did not really talk to them in the sense of negotiating, although the governor does say that he made some concessions to Republican viewpoints. But, you know, if we have a couple more cases like that, will that affect how the relationship is at the end of the session when you do need the bipartisan support? Will the governor have alienated Republicans too much by that point to really get cooperation on things?
And so I wanted to ask you about a couple of bills that we've seen, and one of them that we saw last week was the bill that would raise the age whether people can buy tobacco products in Illinois to 21. First of all, do we know whether or not the governor is going to sign this? This is something, remind me if I'm correct, this is something former Governor Rauner vetoed, right, Mark?
Correct. Governor Rauner vetoed it, and he and many Republicans didn't like part of the bill, which actually eliminates any kind of penalty for those people who would be caught smoking underage. And it shifts the penalty onto the retailer or the person who owns the shop who's selling the product. We believe that Governor Pritzker, I don't know if he's gone on the record and said whether or not for sure he will sign it, but if he was to veto or try to tweak this bill, it would certainly send a message of conflict with Senate President John Cullerton. Senate President John Cullerton has been a big advocate of raising the legal smoking age to 21, and so that would certainly be the first sign of any departure from the governor and the Senate president. I don't expect that to happen, but we shall see.
Doug, how did the vote break down with this when we're thinking about this time around with the Tobacco 21 bill?
Well, it got, as I recall it, there was only one Senate Republican who voted in favor of it, but there were a number of House Republicans who voted in favor of it. In fact, it got almost 20 more votes in the House than the override attempt did last fall. So people are coming around. I think the one thing that surprised a lot of people was when House Republican Leader Jim Durkin stood up on the floor and said that he has changed his mind on the bill because his own daughter came to him and said that the idea of smoking or of actually vaping in this case was out of control at her school, she thought. And that's something to consider about this. It's Tobacco 21, but it also puts restrictions on e-cigarettes and vaping devices, and that is an increasing concern for people in both parties.
And Mark, with this bill, I wonder, do we have a sense then the penalty with this Tobacco 21 bill, does that again bring the penalty back to retailers and what Republicans didn't like about it before?
Well, yes, there would be a penalty applied to retailers if they're caught selling tobacco products to, you know, consumers under the age of 21. I believe that penalty was already in place, but it would become stiffer. The change basically goes away from adding any kind of, you know, if a teenager was caught trying to buy cigarettes or with cigarettes underage before, they might have to confront a judge, or, you know, that might raise some red flags with their parents. And so these are the things that Republicans said, hey, let's not do away with that. But Illinois appears headed in a different direction with this for now.
Okay. I wanted to ask Doug about another bill that Governor Rauner vetoed last year that's passed the House and is now in the Senate, and it has to do with pay equity in salary history. Can you tell us about this bill?
Yes, it's the bill prohibits employers from asking for someone's salary history when they come and apply for a job. And it's basically the argument against that is that Women tend to be generally underpaid compared to men for comparable work. And if you can ask for a person's salary history, you can perpetuate that going forward. And so if a woman has traditionally been paid less than a man, she tries to apply for a new job, you look at her salary history, and you decide you don't have to pay her as much. So this bill would outlaw that practice. Presumably, I know the governor is in favor of this because, he issued an executive order very early in his term prohibiting state agencies from asking for salary history from applicants. So if this bill gets to his desk, presumably he will sign it. Former Governor Rauner vetoed it. He mandatorily vetoed it, as I recall. He said that Massachusetts had a system for dealing with this that he thought was superior to what the Illinois law was, and he wanted lawmakers to adopt that. Critics of that generally believed that the Massachusetts system was a little too business-friendly and kind of watered down the intent of the bill, so it did not do accept his proposed changes.
And so, Mark, as Doug was talking about, not just apply, of course, to state workers or to government workers, but to the private sector as well, prohibiting salary history. What is the sense of we're looking at this in the Senate? Is this a bipartisan thing in the Senate, or when is this issue maybe in one that Republicans are also supporting?
I believe that last session, the Senate did pass this with two Republican votes. One of those votes, Senator Chris Nybo, no longer in the Senate. But there still should be some, we expect, some bipartisan support there. The truth is, there doesn't need to be. The votes do appear to be there. This passed the Senate last time around. And if this heads to the governor's desk and he signs it, it means that when women walk into that job interview, and men, the employer cannot ask them for that last, you know, how much did you make in your last job? And so someone who might have taken a long duration off during, a maternity leave or raising a young kid and might feel that apprehension about going back into the job interview, maybe they can rest a little easier knowing that that employer cannot ask them that question and therefore can't peg them into a lower salary. They can negotiate their salary without that sort of I don't want to call it baggage, but without that history.
Right, which is, as we were talking about, the gender pay gap. We're talking state politics with Mark Maxwell and Doug Finke, both of them in Springfield. Doug with the State Journal Register, Mark with WCIA3. And so when we think about just the Capitol bill, Doug, I wanted to ask you, as we think about specific type of bills, I actually want to ask you about the Capitol bill. And I wonder if it's an accurate way to describe this, if you can remind us about the Capitol bill. I was wondering if we can think of this as, like, in terms of how big the bill is and how important it is. Is this kind of like a federal state equivalent of like the federal farm bill for Illinois?
In a sense, the good news is that there is widespread bipartisan support for the idea of a capital bill, and it would cover everything from roads to water projects to small building projects, presumably some school construction projects. The state hasn't had a new capital bill for a decade now. And there's a lot of pent-up need out there for this. So there's agreement for everyone that we need a bill, and certainly lawmakers like the idea of being able to bring some money back to their districts for various projects. The one hang-up that we have is there's no agreement yet on how to pay for it, and that is always the rub with these sort of things.
Right. And, Mark, I imagine that's where the partisan breakdown comes down to these bills. I mean, when you're talking about infrastructure, the idea is, and I wonder if this is where the party breakdown is, how are you going to pay for this?
Right. And really look to Senate Minority Leader Bill Brady in this to get a sense of how bipartisan this will be. He's been a big supporter of the idea of a capital bill and more open to some new taxes than most Republicans. One example is what to do about the gas tax. Should there be a higher gas tax with a trade-off for reducing the sales tax at the pump? There's been some negotiation there, but it's interesting. We actually don't hear many public comments from the lawmakers now about the Capitol bill. And that may be a sign that because those discussions are going on in private and they're still trying to find some way to settle on what, you know, what is the middle ground here. But certainly the Capitol bill, because of the regional divide too, and all the different projects, remember, Governor Pritzker promised a downstate revitalization in his inaugural address,
mm-hmm.
and the Capitol bill will be the measure of what that looks like.
And then he talked about it again when he went to Carbondale, right? That was his first visit after.
He did, and he went to he's in Belleville today for the second time in, 6 weeks? So he's certainly trying to make some of those connections and get support. But I expect he's going to ask some of those Republicans along the way to maybe keep an open mind and perhaps support his progressive income tax. I'm not sure how much response he'll get there, though.
Right. We're almost out of time. Mark, let me just ask you really quickly. Is the fact that perhaps you said about not hearing things, maybe that means behind-the-scenes negotiations are going on. Do you think that's also true with a budget?
Well, certainly that's always the case. The four leaders are the ones who, when they say a budget can be done, and really the two leaders that are in the Democratic majority have outsized power compared to previous General Assemblies. But yes, those negotiations are ongoing. There does seem to be an open process, too. Many of the different stakeholders in the state are coming to the General Assembly asking and making their budget requests in these months leading up to that budget negotiation. But certainly those talks are happening in public and in private.
That is Mark Maxwell from the newsroom of WCIA, where he's the Capitol Bureau Chief. I want to thank Doug Finke for joining us from the State Journal Register's newsroom. He's a State House reporter. Mark, Doug, thanks for taking time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Good luck with your bracket.
Thank you. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel Simon is visiting the Midwest. He's at Beloit College. He's going to join us from that Wisconsin campus just after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois. Presenting Between the Buildings, Art from Chicago, highlighting CAM's collection of work by Chicago artists. Open now through March 23rd. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, hundreds of journalists around the world are attacked, imprisoned, kidnapped, or killed. If you think even back on the past year, many names come to mind. Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered at the Saudi embassy in Turkey, the Capital Gazette in Maryland, where five employees were shot and killed last summer, and some recent cases just in the past month, like Maria Ressa, who was arrested in the Philippines, or the Sacramento Bee's Dale Kessler, who was briefly detained by police a few weeks ago after covering a protest. The Committee to Protect Journalists tracks all of these cases. It's a nonprofit dedicated to not just defending the work of journalists, but also press freedom all over the world. And as executive director of this organization, Joel Simon knows these stories well. He's in the Midwest doing a visiting residency at Beloit College. And this week, he's helping the school cap off a year of programming on freedom of the press. And he's joining us now from the Wisconsin campus. Joel, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
I want to get to the imprisonments and talk about all of that in a little bit, but I just wanted to actually start with the topic of your new book. It's called We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Hostages and Ransom. And I just wanted to start by asking, do we know how many people, not just journalists, but aid workers or other vulnerable people that you cover in this book, are kidnapped? And I'm not talking about for criminal purposes, but for essentially political ones.
You know, one of the things I found in researching the book is that numbers are very hard to come by. And that's part of the problem because we don't have terrific data when we're looking at this issue and how to respond. Many cases of hostage taking are kept secret for a variety of reasons. The hostage takers may ask that it not be reported, or the families or employers may desire to keep it secret. Keep in mind that a lot of these kinds of crimes, they don't necessarily target Westerners, and those are cases we hear about, but local communities in the countries where, you know, that are experiencing conflict. So we don't have terrific data, but, you know, at any given moment, you know, I would say there are probably a dozen or two dozen cases of, let's call them, you know, Westerners who are being kidnapped and held for ransom by political groups. But as I said, we don't have precise data on this.
And I think we tend to think of the cases that grab the headlines or mm-hmm. get the most attention, and those are the most horrific ones. And I'm thinking, of course, of James Foley, who was beheaded by ISIS, or the Daniel Pearls of the world mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. The reality is most of the journalists who get killed, though, are local journalists who don't get as much attention as Western journalists, right?
Absolutely. It's the vast majority of journalists killed around the world are local journalists. The vast majority of journalists who are kidnapped as a result of their work are local journalists. The vast majority of journalists imprisoned around the world are local journalists imprisoned by their own governments in their own countries. You know, what we found, though, is that this kind of repressive action actually has a tremendous impact on the global information environment. And in a sense, it really impacts what we know, because the structure of the media these days when it comes to international events is that information crosses borders easily. So if there is repression of journalists in one country through violence or through jailings or other forms of intimidation or censorship, then it not only impacts the people in that country, it impacts all of us. And one way of putting this as a phrase that Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, who's written a lot about this issue, coined as, you know, censorship anywhere is censorship everywhere. If a journalist is censored in a particular country, it affects the people there, but it affects all of us around the world who are looking for independent news and information.
And it's interesting that you say that, because I wonder how much we tend to think that censorship happens outside the U.S.
Yeah, it does. It does happen outside the U.S., but the
it also happens here.
Right, the system of information. I mean, you know, think about the structure of the media. 20, 30 years ago, when, you know, large media organizations deployed their correspondents to countries around the world, and you have the kind of traditional notion of the, you know, the war correspondent in their vest standing up and delivering news from the scene. That's a really sort of obsolete and quaint notion of how news circulates now. So really, it circulates based on local journalists working in their own countries. That information is accessed by people within the country or journalists outside the country. And then it's disseminated, sometimes through informal means or social media or different forms. And then it's also processed through the media. And that's how we access this information. So this is not some, you know, feel good, kind of exercise. We obviously, I do feel very personally and viscerally that we have to defend the rights of these journalists, but there's a certain self-interest here. You know, these are the people who are actually reporting for us, who are keeping us informed about events in Venezuela, which is very much in the news, or Syria or Iraq or Mexico. And, you know, because of my background as a journalist working in Latin America, I follow the news very closely from that part of the world. And these are the people, I believe, who are keeping me informed. And so I really take personally my responsibility to defend their rights.
And I wonder then if we can talk a little bit about the case of James Foley.
Mm-hmm.
His mother, Diane, is why you wrote this book.
Right.
What did she say to you that inspired this research?
Well, you know, unfortunately, kidnapping is an occupational hazard for journalists. You know, there's a nature of journalism is that when you're working in a conflict zone and you're trying to gather information, you have to put your trust in people who tell you they have information. You can't protect yourself entirely from those kind of interactions. They're essential to your work.
Right, you can't do it on the phone.
You can't do it on the phone, and you can't walk around with armed guards everywhere. No one's going to talk to you, so you have to engage. And sometimes, you know, that process of being on the ground leads to these kinds of events. That's what happened to Jim Foley. He was kidnapped along with a colleague while reporting in Syria at the end of 2012. And at first, I knew him. He was friends with people in my office, in the office of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we didn't know what had happened to him. And then other journalists began disappearing. It was kind of an epidemic of kidnapping, and we really didn't have a lot of information. And then at some point in the summer of 2013, Diane and her husband, John Foley, came to me, and they decided that they'd heard from the kidnappers, and they decided that they were going to try and raise ransom to bring them to bring their son home. It wasn't clear that there was a line of communication and that this would be successful, but nevertheless, she thought this was her best hope.
Well, and can I stop you for a second? Because she was actually, this is the thing that I didn't realize until I started doing research before I was speaking with you and reading your book. She communicated with ISIS directly, like her family did. This is part of, I think we think of the, I mean, I think it's a very much kind of like a Hollywood Washington line where they're like, we don't, the U.S. government does not negotiate with terrorists. But in this case, this is actually what happened, because the U.S. government does not negotiate with terrorists. Her family, they were, their family was dealing with
ISIS. Their family was dealing with ISIS, and that's how it works. You know, if you are, now this is only applies if you are the victim of a designated terrorist group, then under U.S. law you can't negotiate. Legally you cannot pay ransom. The family actually legally cannot pay ransom. They had decided they were going to do it anyway. They
but
felt
they could be prosecuted.
Potentially they could be prosecuted, and they felt abandoned by the U.S. government. They felt that this was absurd, that they were on their own having to do this, and they came to me and they said, well, you help us raise the money. And I was worried about my own legal jeopardy, about my organization's legal jeopardy, and also about the possibility that paying ransom could lead to further kidnapping. And after, you know, obviously this was unsuccessful. Jim was killed, and afterwards Diane came to me, and we had a sort of heart-to-heart. And, you know, I told her that I, you know, that the premise of this whole, the rationale for this policy, if we don't negotiate, is that it will lead to, it will further endanger Americans who will be targets of future kidnappings. And I said to Diane, look, as a journalist, I think I have an obligation to really look into this issue and understand it. And that's what led to the book. And I traveled to Europe, where they do routinely pay ransom, and interviewed all sorts of people and looked at the cost benefit of this policy. And that was the origins of the book.
And so that line from the we want to negotiate is actually from an email that ISIS sent to the Foley family.
Correct.
And that was part of the email. But I wonder if we could just ask, if we could start taking apart that a little bit, the notion that, and I think this is a very common American notion, well, if you pay hostages, then it will make Americans more of a target. But do we know if that's true?
Actually, we don't. I really dug down into the research. The origins of the policy, which I was unaware of, are quite striking. So in 1973, two U.S. diplomats were kidnapped by Palestinian terrorists who took over the Saudi embassy in Khartoum. And the next day, President Nixon had a press conference. The kidnappers had made demands, and President Nixon said, you know, we're not going to negotiate, we won't, you know, succumb to blackmail, and the hostage takers killed these two American diplomats. And after that, according to people I talked to, you know, the policy was sort of written in blood. It was sort of uttered in this moment, but the U.S. was not going to back down. And a lot of the justifications for the policy came afterwards. And, you know, when you look at the data, you know, for the most part, kidnapping is an opportunistic crime. When groups target Westerners, they're not really checking passports. They're looking for people who are identifiably Western, and then they're grabbing them. And so, you know, whether you are a country that pays ransom or not, the kidnappers don't know that usually at the time they grab the person. Where there is data, and this was quite shocking, that and it is a correlation, is so people who are kidnapped, citizens of countries like France, like Spain, like Italy, where the governments are known to negotiate and even pay ransom, those victims almost always come home. Americans, about 75% are killed in these situations. So there's a very, very high cost for this policy in terms of human life. And my view at the end of my research was, if we're paying this cost in human lives, then the corresponding part of the policy has to be held up by data, i.e. it makes us safer. And I didn't see a lot of evidence of that.
My guest is Joel Simon. He's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And his most recent book is called We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Hostages and Ransom. Joel, I wonder if we could just, if you could explain a little bit more, because I didn't realize how different, until I was reading your book, how different the Spanish or French approach is to this than the American one. And I think part of this is the very secretive nature. Oftentimes when Americans are kidnapped, whether they're aid workers or journalists, we don't know about it. But in Spain and in France, this is a much more public situation, and it's sort of a part of the public awareness, and it becomes a political issue.
Yeah, what I found was that, you know, this is an issue which is really filtered through each country's political culture. And the two countries that, you know, are the leading voice of this "we don't negotiate" posture are the U.S. and the U.K. And in those countries, you know, we won't negotiate, we won't give in. That has a sort of political resonance that you know, just Americans respond to. It sounds tough. It sounds like we're holding the line. In France, they have a more flexible attitude, but what I found was that the political calculation is a little different. It really is about how much public pressure you can put on the government, and that means bringing people into the street, because France is a culture in which the government responds to political mobilization. So if you can bring a lot of people into the street, if you can make a lot of noise, if you can put pressure on the government and they feel they have to do what they can to bring the person home, then you can compel them to pay, because often that's the only mechanism they have to bring French hostages home. And so in many cases they do pay, but not all. Spain, on the other hand, just because the political culture there is somewhat different, the government and different governments, the conservative and the liberal government through different administrations, has sort of come to the conclusion that the Spanish public wants them to bring Spanish hostages home. And so they've essentially given instructions to the intelligence services, you know, this is something that is a national priority, bring these people home. And that means you don't have to get out into the street, you don't have to protest, because there's a sense that the government is doing what it can. And actually, in my research, I found that Spain has the highest rate of recovery. 100% of Spanish hostages have come home. The cost of that policy, of course, is millions of dollars going to terror groups. That has its own, that has consequences, clearly, but that is the calculation that the Spanish government has made.
So there's that moral question, which I want to get to in a second, but then I think there's also a practical question, which is then, I think a lot are also the conventional thinking goes, well, if the Spanish and French pay, then they must get kidnapped more.
Yeah, well, that is just, there isn't any correlation. There isn't evidence to suggest that there's a strong correlation between the risk of kidnapping and the policies of a particular country vis-a-vis concessions or no concessions. There is some sort of situational, regional evidence that this may occur in some circumstances, but overall the data does not suggest that this is the case. I think the harder question is the second one I identified, which is, you know, when you pay, the money goes to terror groups that use it for terrible purposes, and those terrible purposes often don't impact Europeans or Americans or British people, they impact local populations. And that's a much more complex issue, because there I think it's harder to make the case that this does not have an impact. But what I found in my research is that these dual policies of some countries pay, some countries don't, actually creates the ideal conditions for may increase the amount of money going to terror organizations, because it creates ideal conditions for terror organizations, when they kidnap groups of hostages, to kill the hostages that have no value from the countries that don't negotiate, in order to put pressure on the countries that do. And there's even an intercepted email from Osama bin Laden, where he was given advice to an Al-Qaeda affiliate in North Africa on how to negotiate. And he said, you know, kill the least valuable hostage. And in nearly every case, that's going to be a Brit or an American, because these are the countries that do not pay.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Joel Simon. He's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're actually speaking to him from Beloit, Wisconsin, where he is doing a visiting residency at Beloit College this week. He's got an address actually on Friday. He is helping the university cap off a year of programming on the freedom of the press. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Joel Simon. Stay close, just after the short break. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. So far this year, three journalists have been killed for or while doing their work. That brings the total to 57 of the number of journalists who've been killed since January 1st, 2018. As the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Joel Simon knows not just these statistics, but these stories very well. He's in the Midwest doing a visiting residency at Beloit College this week. He's helping the school cap off a year of programming on the freedom of the press. And we've been talking about his most recent book. It's called We Want to Negotiate: The Secret World of Hostages and Ransom. And Joel, of course, this does come down to what you were just talking about before the break, which is the moral question about clearly funding, moral and practical, right? Because you're funding terror organizations who may eventually end up killing even more people than the hostages who were involved.
Yeah, that is the thorniest part of this dilemma. And that's really what it is. It's a moral dilemma. It's a political dilemma. But yes, that is the key challenge. But, you know, hostage taking is a tactic that is employed in every conflict, and it has tremendous coercive power. And so trying to sort of combat it as a separate tactic would be like trying to combat, you know, car bombing and isolating it from the conflict. You really have to sort of look holistically. How can you address the broader context in which the conflict is taking place, i.e., how can you make peace? You know, everywhere that you've seen surges in kidnappings, whether they're in Colombia, during the conflict there, or in Lebanon in the 1970s, or in Syria more recently, you know, it's a part of the conflict, and the kidnapping ends, you know, when the conflict ends. It doesn't end because you have a particular policy that really doesn't seem to correlate. So I think the broader context in which we have to look at this is not how do we stop kidnapping, but how do we minimize its impact? And I think that, you know, where there can be cooperation is between countries that do engage and do negotiate and countries that may be more reluctant to do so, you know, to move towards a more flexible understanding and to work together to minimize the amount of the ransom. Not eliminate it, that's impossible. But, you know, multi-million dollar large ransoms, no question they fund the activities of these terror groups and can prolong the conflicts. But asking families to walk away or employers to walk away and let people die is not really practical either. So that's the common ground. It's an immensely complex and difficult issue, but I think that's where the focus needs to be.
And to the point of the American policy, which is we don't negotiate with terrorists, I just want to contrast that with, I'm just thinking of, there's a line in the book, a French journalist who was previously kidnapped and now is one of the biggest and most vocal advocates and supporters of other journalists who were kidnapped or aid workers or other people, because we're not just talking about journalists here. Florence Abuena, she said that democracy is actually talking to everyone, which is a very different attitude than we have.
Yeah, she's a bit of a contrarian. She's an amazing person. She endured a terrible kidnapping in Iraq. Her country paid a ransom to win her release. She told me she's not particularly curious about what they did. She knows that happened. She doesn't know the details. She's grateful to be alive, and she feels she has an obligation to stand up for others who are victims of this crime. And her view, which is not universally held in France, certainly, is that democracy really is, you know, about an affirmation of engaging through dialogue with your adversaries. That's a key democratic principle. And the other thing is that being willing to engage with these terrorist groups to protect a human life is a way of undermining their propaganda, in a sense, which is that your life is worthless. Your life is worthless. We can just kill you, or we can sacrifice you for some monetary or political end. So the engagement of your government is really a rebuttal and saying, no, the life of this single individual matters. It matters to us. It matters to the community. It matters to their country. That's her view. That engagement is actually a rebuttal of the kind of political objective and financial objective that terror groups hope to achieve by engaging in this practice.
And contrast that with the U.S. version of this, and particularly when it comes to the Foley family. Mm-hmm. We talked about this before. The Foley family was literally talking to ISIS and then telling the FBI what they said because the U.S. government wasn't involved. I wonder how Dianne Foley's very public stances have changed the way the U.S. goes about dealing with this now.
Dianne Foley is one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. I mean, she took this unimaginable and unendurable for most people tragedy and used it as an opportunity to engage with the U.S. government about one of the most difficult and complex issues that governments confront. And, you know, as a result of the advocacy that she undertook, along with the other American families who were victims of these horrendous...
The Sotloffs.
The Sotloffs and the Kasigs and the Muellers and other families. And she challenged the government, and to its credit, the Obama administration carried out a hostage policy review in 2015. They announced some changes. One of them was that they would now communicate, although not negotiate, communicate with hostage takers. They created new structures within the FBI that facilitated support for the families. But the one thing that the Obama administration made clear was not on the table was the no concessions framework. They took that right off the table at the beginning. So that remains our policy. And, you know, what's interesting is that the Trump administration has actually prioritized this issue and is engaging not so much with terror groups, but with rogue governments that also take American sort of judicial hostages, put them in jail without justification as a way of exerting influence and coercion. So it remains a very relevant and important issue, and it is one that has now transcended these two administrations.
On Friday, a group of news outlets, including the Associated Press, Reuters, the Financial Times, and more, announced the One Free Press Association, where each month they're going to publish the 10 most urgent cases. I wonder if you feel like we're in a moment now where press freedom is more on people's radar? Are we sort of at a heightened sense of awareness about this now?
I think absolutely. I think there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, in this country, President Trump has made this a very relevant issue. You know, with his constant attacks on the media, with his sort of framing of critical journalism as fake news, with his denunciation of journalists as enemies of the people. I mean, that's not really an attack on individual journalists. That's an attack on the role of journalism in our democracy. So people are very cognizant of what's at stake. I think the Jamal Khashoggi murder, this, you know, columnist for the Washington Post who was lured into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then strangled and chopped up with a bone saw, and his body was disposed of on the orders of allegedly the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, a key U.S. ally, you know, has really also engaged the public in a way that I've not seen. So I think people realize what's at stake. Partly they realize what's at stake because of the challenges are unprecedented. You know, more journalists in prison around the world than we've ever seen over the last few years, higher levels of violence, just a real lack of political support from leaders who you would expect would be allies of press freedom. So the issues have never been more acute. And we feel that through this campaign, which CPJ is a partner on, and these media organizations that you mentioned are using our data and our cases and cases from the International Women's Media Foundation, which also advocates for press freedom, particularly for women journalists, to highlight key cases, to try and engage the public, to try and engage policymakers. You know, one is Maria Ressa. She's actually an American citizen. She grew up in the United States, back and forth to the Philippines. Her parents are Filipina. She moved back to the Philippines, was a correspondent for CNN, then worked for the Philippine media, and is now the editor of this just incredible, remarkable independent website, which is holding President Duterte, who's an incredibly brutal leader. He's, you know, taken personal responsibility and a certain pride in you know, these essentially, you know, extrajudicial killings of alleged drug dealers, and you know, he's trying to combat the scourge of drug related violence in the Philippines through basically the death squads. And you know, Maria Ed Rappler, her media organization, have held into account. And she's come under tremendous attack. She was recently arrested.
So she was, she was arrested for cyber libel.
Yeah.
So I wonder how often are you seeing governments, I don't know if this is would be considered like legal cover for targeting journalists?
Yeah, well, absolutely. There are a variety of legal strategies. One thing we're seeing around the world and in the Philippines as well is governments are framing their repressive action as combating fake news. They're picking up on the President Trump's framework and using that to justify repression of the media. So that's something that alarms us a great deal. Yeah, but the cyber libel. Libel is libel. There are civil consequences for libel in democratic countries. So nobody denies that libel is a thing and it can happen. But what's what the Philippine government is doing is really using this retroactive application of this. Of an article that they allege libeled someone and criminalizing it, which is really also something you don't see in democratic countries. So they're really throwing everything they have at Maria Ressa and Rappler. They're trying to bankrupt her. They're using illegitimate means. They're trying to pressure her. You know, Maria believes and we believe that she needs the support of the global journalism community, from people all over the world who believe in press freedom, from people all over the world who want to be informed, who want to see, journalism challenge and hold accountable leaders who don't want public scrutiny. That's the role of journalism, and Maria has sort of come to embody the very best ideals of our profession.
I wanted to just ask you one last question, Joel, and that is about the role of how we view journalists in this country. And I was listening to another interview that you did actually on 1A with Joshua Johnson, and one of the listeners was commenting that a journalist who goes to a foreign war zone to cover something is, to quote this listener, meat on the street. And not that deserves to be kidnapped, but if that happens, that's just kind of an occupational hazard. And I just wonder if this essentially, like, I can't help but contrast that view with thinking about the French view of the way the French public rallies around journalists or others who have been kidnapped. And I wonder if you just think we see journalism differently in this country. Like, if we, for example, we wouldn't think that of a soldier, but we think that a journalist isn't maybe worth as much.
Well, I think it really depends on how you view the value of what that, journalist does. If you think that what the work that journalist is doing has no value, then you think they're reckless. If you think it has real value, then you understand that they're taking a necessary risk. I mean, as I think I answered that question by saying, we don't question whether it's worth it for a firefighter to run into a burning building. That's their job. And journalists, the job of journalists is to report. In many instances, on conflict, on violence, we have to believe that as a society, we value that information. We want that information because it infects all aspects of our lives. Things that we're debating, like immigration, like national security, like climate change, like humanitarian needs, income inequality. You name it. All of these key defining issues of our time, in order to address them, we need information, and not just information from next door, but from around the world. And the only way we're going to get that information is if journalists go there and take that risk. And sometimes they miscalculate, and sometimes things go wrong. And then I think we as a society have to ask ourselves, do we value this work? Are we going to stand up for them? Are we going to defend them? Are we going to defend their rights? And are we going to defend the rights of the local journalists in those countries who are also working to keep us all informed? So it's very hard to do that because I think people have a conception of the media because this is what they're exposed to, people screaming at each other across the cable news divide or getting into shouting matches in the White House press briefing room, and that. That some of journalism involves that kind of we have a free speech framework and some journalism involves that sort of thing. But the journalism I think we need to value most is the journalism that keeps us informed, that allows us to make decisions about our lives, that allows us to understand our local, national, and global contexts. And when journalists get into trouble doing that kind of work, it's my personal view that we need to stand up as a society and defend their rights.
His most recent book is called We Want to Negotiate: The Secret World of Hostages and Ransom, and he's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, thanks for taking the time to speak with me this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, well, that does it for us today. We're almost out of time. Coming up on tomorrow's program, I'm out of the office for the rest of the week. Brian Mackey is filling in. He's going to be talking about our pension system and how constantly thinking about it as a crisis might make it harder to solve the problem. You can go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.